All right. So here we have a panel of four distinguished folks. Let me give you a quick introduction to each of them. J.T. Smith is the founder of and CEO of Plainback, the makers of WebGUI. WebGUI is open source. Plainback has achieved the impossible under the leadership of J.T. Smith, and has built a successful business around their popular content management system. Ed Kelly is a partner with the prestigious law firm of Ropes & Gray, particular expertise in intellectual property strategies for high-tech companies, and he's been counsel to many software pioneers. Looking at who is in the audience today, it's probably a good idea to mention that before he became one of the finest high-tech intellectual property lawyers, Ed Kelly was a hardware and software designer, engineer at Raytheon. Ed Boyajian is vice president of marketing at Red Hat. As you all know, Red Hat is one of the most popular Linux distributions in the world. And besides delivering high-quality enterprise and desktop-level operating systems, it is one of the only open-source companies with revenues in the what color?
Black.
Black. That actually will entitle Ed to speak first. And Gregor Rafus is a member of the OSCOM board and one of the organizers at this conference. He's primarily an active open-source CMS developer. I refer to him as the Duke of PostNuke. More recently, he's dedicated his time to development of Wiona AG. Gregor knows the open source CMS community as well as anybody out there. All right, now what we're going to do is I'm going to ask each of these gentlemen if they'll say a word to you on this subject that we posed this morning. That is, can you make money in open source? Then I hope to ask them a few questions myself and then open it up to back and forth with all of you. So, Ed, would you lead us off?
Great. Thank you, Charles, and thank you all for joining us today. It's a delight to be here. And I guess because we, in fact, are in the black, I have the honor of getting to speak first. And let me take a step back as I read the question that was posed here, can you make money in open source? I have to say that from Red Hat's perspective, we absolutely believe it's doable and achievable, and not only that, we think it's critically important that developers and the community find a way to monetize the value that they create as part of the open source development initiatives they participate in. And we've built an entire company on that, and that's really been driven by the demands of enterprise customers, and I think that pointing out. If you take a look at how Red Hat's become successful in this space, and I think we can make it more granular down to an individual level in a minute. If you look at how enterprises make decisions, they're always evaluating two things. They're looking at a balance of risk and value. And we all have experiences in our past, or you may know, and you certainly read in the press of those cases where companies spend quite a bit of money on proprietary technology solutions that give them functional capabilities that they need, but more importantly, that minimize the risk that they are exposed to. Open source technologies have been perceived as very risky from an enterprise perspective because there haven't typically been places to go to get the hand-holding and the kind of support that most enterprise customers demand. And that's really prevented enterprises from adopting open source more rapidly. Red Hat, I think, has played an important role in the promotion of open source by bringing order to some of the chaotic nature of open source development, and in so doing, enabling enterprise customers to find a rational way to make more appropriate risk and value decision for their purchases. And so Red Hat has really viewed our role not only in bringing order to some of the chaos that can be associated with open source, but also to provide some of the additional services and support capabilities that most enterprise customers demand. And that really has been the hallmark of what's enabled Red Hat to be successful. That, coupled with the fact that we did an IPO, raised a lot of money at a time when the market was valuing us very highly. That's enabled us to have the kind of cash flow to sustain our business model to the point of success. And a lot of companies didn't get capitalized well enough to achieve that, but in spirit had the right idea. So we've really been the beneficiaries of what open source can bring to enterprise. It radically changes, as you know, the cost equation versus risk for the enterprise, and we're leveraging that. We've been most successful, as you know, in the area of Linux, and our version of Linux has been adopted widely by the enterprise. We recognize the opportunity to do even more in open source, and I think this gets more granular now as to how those of you who are developers in open source technologies can monetize the value that you've created. Red Hat acquired a company a little over a year ago, in fact, right here in Cambridge, that was called Aris Digita, and I see a few of our old colleagues here in the audience today, but did so in recognition that there was an opportunity to commoditize a large, mature, and growing market space, and that was the content management space and the portal space. And in recognizing that opportunity, if you look at those segments, they're multi-billion dollar segments depending on which analyst report you look at, we looked at those segments as being ripe for commoditization, and we fundamentally believe that the community development model, that the open source development model, is the appropriate alternative when commoditization is when an industry is ripe for that commoditization. We look for those segments that are large and more mature because that's where money flows from enterprise. And we offer radically different risk and value proposition to enterprise customers as a result. So how did some of the people who were acquired benefit? Some of those people are employees of Red Hat today. They still embrace the values of what open source can do, but they do it in a way that they're actually compensated for that kind of contributions they make. We work now routinely, and in fact we have one of our systems integrator partners here today. We work with systems integrators who take our core technology and bring their development capabilities to the table, but leverage the Red Hat brand for maintenance and support and the other things that the company offers. So there's another way. And these are, in some cases, very small shops, maybe 10 or 12 people, but they have deep relationships with a given business or government organization or whatnot. So we've looked at this as a whole ecosystem that has a lot of dimensions. We surely have not figured out all the ways to help people who do development monetize that value, but I think we're on the right track to helping that move forward.
Great. Gregor.
All right. The short answer to the question whether open source companies can make money is yes. I represent Wayona, which is a small Swiss startup. We currently have 7 employees. We have been going at it for about 3 years. Our main pitch is standards. We developed a Java-based, XML-based content management system, which we believe goes further towards standards than similar systems from both the proprietary and open source world, and that's what we capitalize on. We go to our customers, we tell them to avoid lock-in, we give them the spiel about XML as a data format that allows you to migrate to a system and away from a system, so you have continuity. And that worked out pretty well for us. We have been growing. We have been in the black since day one. Recently, we donated our code base to Apache, which we think will help with the exposure. As a small company, as you can imagine, Switzerland doesn't really have a venture capital market, so we are on our own. And it had always been kind of an issue how to spread the word about our company. How could we do the marketing and reach our customers? And we found that going open source gives us a lot more visibility than a company of the same size that's doing a proprietary CMS. Florian Stahl is in the audience. He did a report on content management systems in the European market. And I think one of the things that he found is that most of the products that compete from companies the same size are very much limited to a regional market. Our product offers is available worldwide, which does not necessarily mean our company does projects worldwide, but still it has a lot more credibility because it can leverage the international recognition. Now, I also noticed that Dave Weiner is in the audience, and he has been talking a lot about whether open source can work for a company that does products. To emphasize, we are not a product company, we are a service company. I personally believe that open source programs that are almost at the shrink wrap finish don't really work at this stage. At least I don't know of anyone who has found a viable business model for shrink wrapped open source. So our pitch is more the solutions and frameworks route, and we sell consulting services. And going forward, this is certainly one of the dangers to be aware of. As we improve our core system and as it has more and more features, the scope for consulting diminishes, of course. So what are we going to do about that? I personally think that the pitch for standards can be well extended. There's a lot, I mean, that the source is open, that's a nice fact, but it doesn't give you a lot if you have to dig into the code, and it probably, as an outsider, takes you almost as long as if you would start from scratch. So just having the source code available doesn't give you that many benefits. You need a strong and viable community so that if one little vendor like Viona falls, there are others available. That's why we joined the Apache bandwagon. Then we found that a lot of very conservative companies in Switzerland, like financial companies, the Swiss Stock Exchange, are increasingly focusing on open source and open standards, and the pitch that works for them is the long-term safety of their code base and their data. They really want to make sure that they don't lock away their assets into some systems that goes away. And we really think we can go much further with the standardization than we currently do. Just having XML, for instance, is also not the final answer. We want to avoid the situation where we are becoming commodity as we develop our system. We have to add value all the time. It's kind of a stack. We add features on top, and we have to be very agile. So we kind of like that, and it works out for us. We don't want to grow to 100 persons. So our particular business model might not work well for other companies. But we believe that as we move forward, we try to make our customers not only share their very infrastructure like the framework, but also the website. Out of laziness, we have our customer projects in public CVS, which means that on the one hand, we do have very viable demonstration setups, which are in production, as opposed to the usual widget company or Hello World applications. And on the other hand, it allows people to share and interoperate on a higher level, which is ultimately more useful. I think over time we have to move away from just being a tool set maker and help people to really solve their problems, and also kind of consult them how they can share their particular, let's say, industry or company-specific solutions and make them more generic so that they can reap the benefits of open source for their industry as well. So it's not a thing that just our product is open source, but we really work with our customer to entice them to contribute back their changes into the main system, because otherwise the main line of development goes on and they get out of sync and they have all these issues again. And so far it has been working great for us, and I think that's one of the key reasons why we succeeded so far. Yes.
Thank you, Gregor. JT.
Question is, can you make money at open source? I think that's an obvious question, obvious answer. Yes. There's lots of companies out there. Red Hat is one, Plain Black, Winona, ActiveState, O'Reilly, MySQL, Trolltech, lots of them. Even some you wouldn't think about being open source companies, IBM, Sun, id Software. They all produce open source software. They're all profitable. In order to be profitable, you have to stop thinking like a developer and start thinking like a business. What I mean by that is don't worry about your development model. Don't worry about publishing CVS. Don't worry about talking techie. Worry about the things that businesses worry about. Let's look at the bottom line. Let's look at how are we going to make money. In order to be profitable, you have to have a revenue stream. It's as simple as that. And in order to be really profitable, you have to have multiple revenue streams. One's going to fail, inevitably. You want to be diversified into as many things as possible. And another thing that you have to worry about is there's this perception out there by developers that say, or not by developers, but by consumers of open source software that say, it's just open source, so it's okay if it's crappy. We gotta defeat that myth. It's not okay if it's crappy. We have to be as good or better than commercial providers, and because we're the underdog. So you need to provide the services that the commercial providers provide. You need to give them demo versions that are easy to install with real installers, with online help, with everything. You can't just say, oh, it's good enough because it's open source, because that just lends itself to that myth. I think Gregor said it very well, that the open source community is all about marketing. From a developer standpoint, it's all about that philanthropic view of, you know, we're doing good for the world. But from a business's point of view, open source is about marketing. It's about getting it in the hands of millions of people that you couldn't normally get to. You know, Plain Black works out of Chicago. There's no way I could get to Sweden or China or India or Australia, yet we have clients in all of those countries because we're open source.
So, JT, how did you get started? What was the first big step, the one that said, okay, now I'm making money?
How did we get started? Let's see. I think it was, you know, WebGUI, that's the first product that I started open source. It started as very much a grassroots thing. It was something I did on the nights when I had nothing else to do. And one day, trying to think who it was. It was a big company. Mercury Marine, that's who it was, contacted me and said, we want to use your content management system, but we need these extensions. And so it started out of, you know, somebody needed some help, and they were willing to pay for it. So from day one, profitable. if you make something that people want and you promote it enough, they will come to you. However, I wouldn't recommend that as a business model. I would say you still need your salespeople. You still need your marketing campaigns. You still need to be in magazines and trade publications and at conferences like this. But use the tools that are out there. Use the O'Reilly Network. There's, let's see, last I looked, 604,000 registered users on SourceForge. If you're not using SourceForge, you're making a mistake. Simple as that. There's 160,000 registered users on Fresh Meat. If you're not publishing to Fresh Meat, you're making a mistake. If you're not using the OSDN to the fullest ability, you're making a mistake. I don't know. As simple as that. And I also serve an advisory role at Brunswick Corporation, a boat manufacturer bowling balls and billiards and things like that, fitness equipment. I serve an advisory role for the Brunswick New Technologies Division. They have built a open source integration engine. It wasn't open source originally. They were trying to compete with, you know, Microsoft BizTalk and WebMethods and TIBCO and all of that. But they're a small company, and they're not known for software. They're known for making, you know, bowling balls. So how do you compete against those big companies? Open source, simple solution. We just launched that as open source 2 weeks ago, and I'll be damned if our web traffic hasn't gone up by 1,400%. We're getting sales leads that we couldn't possibly attain through normal means. Huge Fortune 500, Fortune 50 companies coming after us. So that's it. You just got to market. You got to think like a business.
All right, there you go. Ed,
cleanup. All right, cleanup. Let's see. I'm going to kind of play devil's advocate in some ways because I work with a lot of venture capitalists, and they are kind of like the devil, and I kind of advocate for them. And I just want to give you a little sense of like what their perception is, because you want to know, can you make money in the open source, you know, as an open source business? And sometimes, you know, you get a little company going. What you might want to do is actually bring in some outside capital to help you kind of basically get things kind of moving forward more quickly. And everybody here I know knows what a venture capitalist is. In general, venture capitalist for a smallish company is a group of people who usually have either some experience in business and technology. And they come in and they give you money in exchange for portions of your company. And then they take over some sort of management role in your company, typically, for the purpose of trying to build the value up of your company so that they can subsequently sell it or try to do a public offering if there were public offerings anymore. And in that way, they actually kind of make a nice profit, typically, on some portion of the companies they invest in. And that's an important point. It's only a portion, some like, you know, 10%. You know, most of them actually don't really work out. And that's okay. That's just the way companies actually work. And from a venture capitalist point of view, can you make money in the open source model? Their basic attitude is it's tough to make money doing anything in the technology field. It's tough to do it in hardware. It's tough to do it in software. Open source is just one aspect of it. I think in general they kind of look at it as, something that's harmful to do. Typically, you know, software companies make about 50% of their revenue. A traditional kind of software company makes about 50% of its revenue on royalty streams coming in from licensing their software. Why would you give that up? But on the other hand, every now and then you will see a open source company, a company that actually uses open source, just a software company, come and get funded. And typically what they've done is that they've shown that they didn't stumble into open source. They're not here by accident, which is probably the most common thing that drives venture capitalists nuts. Somebody actually starts using open source code, they've developed a product, and just because they weren't really careful about ownership rights or copyrights and things like that, now they're in a situation where they can never do other than be an open source company, and that automatically forecloses a lot of options, that very attractive option of at least having some things, some software you can sell under proprietary license. And that's troubling to them. And the other group that's troubling to them are those that are kind of zealots. And they're interested in doing it merely for philosophical reasons, and that doesn't fit well with the venture capital community at all. But if you actually go to them and you actually explain to them what your business model is, that you believe it's something that helps you with marketing and it can actually get you better sales, it can get you better support, it can get you reached clients that you normally couldn't get to and customers that you couldn't get to, they don't hold it against you. They just look at it again as like one aspect of your company. But I think what you really do need to do if you're interested in bringing in outside money is to show people that being an open source company is something you intended to do. You're a very close accountant of what your intellectual property rights are and what aspects of your product actually are open source, and that you've built flexibility into your work plan. I think pretty much all venture capitalists want to at least hear that there's an option to go ahead and sell the code you're developing under a proprietary license as well. Usually you can do an open source kind of license and then one that's actually proprietary. A good example would be, you know, for if you actually had a kind of code that might run on a handheld as well as on a desktop system, you might want to be able to release things under an open source license to the public, you know, to the desktop kind of system. But you might want to try to cut a deal with HP or Sony where they get a proprietary license for them so they can keep their developments for their handheld computer system. That gives you the kind of flexibility they like to see. I think thinking of those kinds of things, because they do look at you when they're investing in you as basically somebody that's developed not technology so much as an asset for the company, an intellectual property asset. And they want to make sure that you own it and that you have the flexibility to use it the way you want to, so that they can use it so they can guide you to help make money for the company. And a lot of times that means at least having one option where there are proprietary sales you can actually make. I'm trying to think what else we can say. That's about it. I would say one other thing too, which is, you know, we talked about this earlier. No one really, you know, we talk about how to make money in the open source community. It's really, really hard to know what the answer is in that regard. There isn't a lot written on this. It's a relatively new kind of business model. It's one that was born out during pretty strange times, and you know, during an explosion when you really of the economy, when maybe that's the only kind of environment you could have had to actually have open source kind of take off. And since then, things have fallen off very, very much, substantially, so that it's hard to make money in software no matter what you're doing, whether it's proprietary or open source. So it's tough to see right now what the actual solution is going to be. But the more people kind of poke at it, the more it seems like business basics is what it comes down to, which is it's just one element of your company being an open source company. Try to have flexibility and try to use the advantages of being open source as best you actually can.
So let me pose you a hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a friend, Dudley Do-Right, and he just exactly the guy you described, Ed. He stumbled into it. He's a coder. He developed a beautiful CMS plugin,
mm-hmm.
put it out open source. It got picked up. Whoa! Surprised him how widely it got distributed. Excellent reviews in magazines. He's got fame, he's got prestige, he's got everything but money.
Mm-hmm.
He's totally bust.
Yep.
And he says, how do I make a dollar out of this? What do you say to him?
We have seen this story before, all right? And absolutely a good example of this. You put Monty Weedness instead of Dudley Do-Right, and you got the story of MySQL, all right? There they were, these guys that actually TCX had kind of let them kind of cobble this software up on their own. It started doing really, really well. They got a lot of press, a lot of publicity. And venture capitalists, I swear, Charlie, they were knocking on their door trying to get them money to try to take off with it.
Wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
huh?
What?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, 60% of their revenue comes from commercial licenses. A lot of people don't know that, but they have a dual licensing model, and I think you brought that out nicely with the Palm example. Most of their revenue, and they project that in the next couple of years, 90% of their revenue will be commercial licenses. And you don't think about that when you think about an open source company like MySQL, but they are doing it right. There's no one doing it better than MySQL at the moment. Right. They still take contributions.
Hey, hold on. Let me just set a rule here. We cannot have one handheld mode. And I love the idea that you can have sing out the question. I love it. But put your hand up first so it gets into the microphone. Everybody can hear the question.
So I lucked into the microphone. Can I?
All right.
So I want to respond to...
Tell us who you are.
I'm Mike Olson from Sleepy Cat, and I want to respond to the point that no one is doing it better than MySQL. I disagree completely. But I'll tell you why. And it's not because I'm a sleepycat guy. We do embedded data management for those who don't know that. I think that MySQL is sitting on the edge of a very steep cliff, and nobody but the folks at MySQL realize it. Your test, what you just said, indicates that you haven't realized this. They distribute their software under the GPL. The GPL permits people to do what they need to do with the software. MySQL is living on the fact that no one realizes they don't have to pay. Or they think, at $250, it's not worth asking a lawyer for a ruling on what I'm permitted to do with this GPL software. So I'm just going to pay the money. Once a big organization has to spend $250,000, $500,000 for those commercial licenses, they'll go ahead and ask someone who understands the GPL, and MySQL's revenue stream will dry up. They don't, their product, you can use their product under the GPL for commercial purposes without payment. It is uncertainty around that that's allowing them right now to generate license revenues.
Okay, now, Ted, you respond to that. Let me grab the microphone.
Well, let's just talk about, you know, I don't want to talk too much about MySQL in terms of, you know, what actually, you know, their. I don't want to talk about whether or not they're liable under the GPL for infringement. I don't think we really know, you know, what the actual issue is, and I'd actually have to take a look at it. And I'd point out, just the GPL, common mistake. That's not the only open source license. You know, it's an improved one. It's the one everybody thinks of, but there are certainly other open source licenses that could be used to release code, which I think certainly make you, as somebody pointed out or asked earlier, an open source company, but at the same time give you allow you to retain the rights that you need to go ahead and sell proprietary licenses. And I think the reality is that proprietary licenses for open source software are in much more, I find in my practice, are in more demand than you might think. It is a very common request that I get from someone that actually wants to buy open source software. They want to know whether or not there's any way that they can get a proprietary license to it, because they
What does it mean? I want a proprietary license.
Yep.
I don't know. I just feel more comfortable that way. These open source people, they freak me out. If I can pay a little money for it, I'm going to feel more comfortable.
Yeah, we call it the idiot tax.
Say that.
We call it the idiot tax.
Exactly.
All right. There are an open source. We all know what pretty much open source is. You're going to go. It's a method of developing software, but it's also a license. It's the way we talk about a license, where you're going to go ahead and you're going to have certain kind of burdens and obligations on the code. I'm going to release this code to you. You're going to get it. You can use it according to the following parameters, and you have an obligation to go ahead and release your derivative works, the changes and modifications that you made, also under open source. That's the kind of thing that makes a lot of companies' blood run cold. They don't want to go ahead, take somebody's code, let's say it's MySQL, change it, modify it, and then go ahead and have to release their changes open so anyone else can use it. They want to keep it just for them. Palm, I write some nice plugins, some developments for a handheld computer so that now you can run Linux on the handheld a little bit better, a little bit faster. I don't want to release it. It's a tough cutthroat market I'm in right now. I don't want to release it so that Hitachi gets it and Sony gets it. A proprietary license is one where the copyright owner of, let's say, MySQL, they own all the copyright. They can choose to release some of it under open source and some of it under a regular kind of contract where they're saying to somebody, here, you have the right for this limited use to go ahead and use it, and your developments, they can be released as you want to release them.
Yeah, I want to take exception to the point you made that companies want to hold back their changes. In our experience, most of our customers are not in the software business, and they don't want to be in it. And we are working with them to clue them into the fact that it's easier for them if they give back their changes so they don't have to deal with them on their own. And while I agree for the IT industry, that's just a very small part of the market. So for our customers, that's a non-issue. Actually, it's more like the other way around. They ask. We have some customers that ask us whether they can become Apache committers. So they want to contribute.
So I'm still not getting it here. We've got Mike saying that JT just is disconnected. You just don't see it. MySQL's right on the edge of a cliff. They're about, I would sell.
Sell MySQL. Yeah, I don't think they're both.
Can I answer that?
Yeah.
All right. I,
they may be on the edge of a cliff, but what business isn't? When there's money to be made, you take that opportunity. That's what you do as a business. As far as the point that Gregor made, I think he's absolutely right. When you're talking about a regular business, they don't want to be in the software business. Of course, they're going to want to release it back to the community, let the community maintain it. It also keeps their upgrade path going so that they don't have to maintain all these separate things that they did. But when it comes to software development companies that are embedding MySQL, that are using Trolltext QT, that are using SleepyCatsDB, they don't necessarily want to be releasing their changes into the wild. And that's because they are a proprietary software company. Yeah, that's going to dry up eventually. Because eventually, if all of these people here believe what I do, that open source will dominate, there won't be any commercial software companies making money off of selling the bits. It'll be making money off of selling something else, the services, the support, hardware devices that use the software that you've open sourced, whatever that is. But for now, if there's money to be made, why not make it?
Go.
So I have about three. Oh, I'm sorry. Denise Cooper. Dave, where are you? I work for Sun. Dave likes me to say that. Yeah, and I use a Mac. I have about 3,000 things to say. I actually raised my hand about on my SQL, but I agree that customers want a deep pocket to sue. They want liability. And even Evan Moglen, who wrote the current version of the GPL, thinks it's a copyright notice. It's not a contract. So there's lots of stuff that's just not even addressed, unfortunately, in that license, or fortunately, depending on how
although
you look at it.
Although we don't know yet. Although
well,
we
of course,
know.
Until tried. Yeah. But, you know, RMS advised Sun to go dual licensing for OpenOffice. And he wanted to see one of the licenses be a GPL family license and the other one be as proprietary as possible, right? And then, of course, we have to collect copyright notices in order to service the dual licensing. And there's at least one person in the audience who disagrees with the notion of copyright notice, which maybe you guys want to talk about at some point, joint copyright assignment. But back at this advice he gave us, he likes to see that dichotomy because then people who want the freedom, who want to work in that arena, you know, can, but it doesn't scare companies away, and it makes it really clear which side you're on. But it's always kind of troubled me because I think it undermines, in a certain sense, the point of the GPL. And I just got back last night, in fact, from Europe, where they're getting enormous adoption of the GPL-based software, but they're all wanting to write their own version of the GPL. And why do they want to write their own version? Because, of course, they want to sequester some part of their work, you know, typically security layer or something like that. And, you know, I was just at this meeting where I was at pains to say, okay, you guys just have not gotten the point, right? I think this is going to be an ongoing problem. I think it might even be the central problem right now.
Here's my take on that. The primary point of the GPL is to disclaim liability. All right. The reality situation is most people releasing code under the GPL or under an open source license, very few are doing it almost as hobbyists or as very small businesses.
Oh, I so disagree.
Well, I just say, you know, just from my, and if you add into your formulation universities and how much work gets released by universities, they're not going to make money on this. They don't intend to make money on this. Their primary responsibility is to make sure that the university is not held liable for consequential damages, which is I take your version of whatever it is, I run it on my system here at Sun or at some other major corporation. We have the catastrophic failure that everybody's always worried about, and now I'm suing MIT. I mean, the primary responsibility of these licenses is to be a vehicle that allows, at least one major responsibility is to be a vehicle that allows academic research institutions to release code to the public without fear of getting sued. And I think that's an important goal. I think also allowing universities and other institutions to do this, to release another form of their code in a way that actually makes them a little bit of money, is a good thing. So,
My original point before we got to the MySQL was you guys are talking about can they make money. You're saying is it possible to make money. In my experience, I mean, going back 5-6 years, Michael Tiemann, yes, of course I can make money. I'm driving a BMW. But is everybody in the company driving one? And, you know, we're in the middle of the bubble. He, at the time, was advocating that my company release a major part of its intellectual property under open source, and we were saying our shareholders will have our necks if we do that. This is the value of the company, right?
So let me get it straight from Dudley Do-Right's point of view. If I hear you guys right, you're all saying he should basically make money on proprietary licenses. That's what he's got to do. He's got to somehow pull back a little bit with the open source and put stuff out under proprietary license, and that's the way he's going to make his money. Am I hearing you right? Is that it?
No. One revenue stream is that is a possibility. And that depends on your type of company, the type of company you're trying to build. But it really depends on what it is that you're building. What is your product? Is it something that's serviceable? Is it something you can provide support and training and documentation and everything else that goes along with that support revenue stream? Is it the case where you're building some sort of hardware or network appliance that the software part is irrelevant? It's actually the device, the package that you're selling, that is the value. And so the software you open source, you get some extra features, you get lots of code review, and you get all the benefits of open source. But your product really is this appliance that you're selling, not the bits themselves. It really depends on the product.
Tell us who you are.
Hi, my name is Chalu. I have run an open source, quote unquote, integrator company in New York. And I'd like to actually benefit from some panelists' comments. I have like a contract that is written in a general way, like a proprietary way. And we are hashing out, and the contract negotiation is taking weeks to hash out what they're gonna own and what we can keep, as well as protecting any of the, making them aware of the fact that they're using open source code. So, Mr. Dudley, his problem is also my problem, because it happens to be a very large company. And I guess if you have like a, I'm hearing a lot of pros and cons about, my way is right way, and people are giving me money, and as long as that's great. But as people who are very close to working with these, enterprise computings, it's a real battle. And if you have like advices and examples of contracts that sort of does justice to the concern that was to the question, I hope that you make some comments about the samples work or any contract work. I don't know.
Well, let me just focus the question. Ed, do you want to go?
I'd like to address it, but I don't want to address a contract question, because I don't think that's the issue. And I think I've heard it said actually here, open source is a business model. Open source isn't a business model. Open source is a development model. And I think as an individual developer who may be thinking about creating a business around your own development, you have to be mindful of that. Open source is a development model. Now, there are a variety of business models that you could build around open source to create a successful and profitable business. But until you understand the distinction and can separate those issues, I think it's very difficult to talk about how you can actually make money. The contract issue is, to me, is rooted partly in a business model issue and how you choose to interact with your customers. It's when we wrap that into the open, we make that an open source issue that they become very difficult to filter through. I certainly could say more about open source as a development model versus a business model, but I don't know that specifically addresses the question.
There you go.
Okay, Larry Rosen from Open Source Initiative. It seems to me that the question is a little bit different than the way it's been addressed so far by the panel. There is a lot of money to be made in open source, and the companies that are making it are IBM and HP and Sun, and the reason we know they're making it is because they're investing a huge amount of money in open source. And they're devoting large amounts of their own technical resources, assigning them to open source projects. So one of the questions that I'd want to turn back to the panel is there any way for open source companies to compete effectively and to prevent the open source development from being co-opted and managed and run by big companies that are more than willing to give stuff away particularly stuff they didn't write, in exchange for selling a lot of other stuff. Can open source companies, small ones like yours, compete effectively against the big guys who are buying into open source in a big way?
Huh. Ed, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I think they can, actually. I also think you have to kind of separate. You have to start thinking like an individual or a business. If you're an individual who wants to just write code and have no ambition to be a company around that code, then I think you pursue a different path to make money doing that. And so we have kind of a mixed audience here. If you've developed some code, for example, that you think is product worthy or enterprise worthy, that you want to make available as open source, then I think you address the issue of how do I build a business successfully around that. Here's what I think. Big mature markets like content management, I think it's going to be tough for a small player to make a product and penetrate successfully. There are big vendors playing, companies like Red Hat, certainly companies with the likes of IBM, Sun, and others, who are making material investments in developing the community and have the infrastructure to do that. So I would say in large, more mature markets, it's going to be tough. But I think there are plenty of smaller, important markets where enterprises are making investments in technologies today that are proprietary, and they're spending extraordinary amounts of money to do it, where open source initiatives can offer that same cost to value alternative. So the question then becomes is how do I build my business around that? What are the things that are going to allow me to actually monetize the value? Well, the first thing is that you start with a solid code base. The next thing enterprises need to see is that you have a plan for developing that technology further. What's that mean? You've got to have a product roadmap. You actually have to have a model for future development. That requires that you actually build out your community. So as you begin to think about where do I go with this base of code, you need to think about I'm going to build a community, and then I'm going to be able to offer an alternative to an existing product. So what are they going to pay me for? What could they pay you for? They can pay you for that product roadmap. They can pay you for maintaining that product. They can pay you for adding enhancements to that product. They can pay you for your domain expertise around that technology.
But if I'm Dudley Do-Right, I'm a coder, I'm lost in this world, right? I mean, I've made the code so that they really don't, it's so good, nobody needs to consult with me to run it. They just, it's right there. It's just transparent. And I'm not a salesman. I'm a coder. I'm not a marketer. I'm just think I'll get a job. That's what I think.
I guess that begs the question, is Dudley, what's Dudley doing it for? Did he do this to make a business? I think we're mixing it, right? I think one of the questions, Larry's question is, somebody has the idea to make this into a business, and they want to leverage an open source development model as part of their business model.
Dave, tell us who you are.
I'm Dave Weiner from Berkman Center here at Harvard. My opinion is that everybody... of course you can make money at open source. What Dudley Do-Right has to do is keep some of it proprietary and deliver some of it open source, and everybody does that. Keep some of it proprietary. Everybody does this. Even Microsoft releases some of its code as open source, even though they don't use a GPL or one of the established licenses. You know, the practice of releasing source code has been going on ever since people started writing software. It goes all the way back to the beginning. When Microsoft delivers sample source for their basic compiler or whatever, isn't that open source? I mean, I had Philip Greenspun, you know, who's a very smart guy, ask me if a product that I created was open source. And I said, no, it's not open source. He says, well, do you ship the source? And I said, yeah. He says, well, it's open source. You know, so, I mean, if you get pragmatic about it, okay, if you ship the source, in my opinion, you're open source. I don't get specific. I don't worry about what license you used. Because I know that if a programmer has the source code, they're going to do whatever the hell they want to do with it anyway, no matter what license you put on it. You know, all this nitpicking about, well, does the license permit me to do what I want to do? Come on, programmers do what they want to do. If they got the source, they're going to do it. Now, the other thing, I wanted to share this. I was at a Jabber conference a couple of summers ago, and at the time I was thinking about doing a big open source release. And I talked with the CEOs of a bunch of open source companies, and this was after the bubble burst, and these guys were all looking at the reality, what their companies were going to look like after, you know, they actually have to make a living doing this stuff. And they all said, you're crazy. Why are you doing that? We all wish we were in your position, where we had tons of proprietary code. Now, I've also heard that Red Hat has proprietary code as well, but doesn't like to talk about it. I think they all have it. You know, basically, if you don't have it, I don't think you have much of a future. And I don't think there's anything wrong with selling something unique and also giving something away, because if, you know, if you want to create a standard, if you want competition, if you want people to follow you, you have to give something away. You don't have that, you know, can you make money by setting a standard, Charlie? I believe you can. I think that that's a good thing for a business, to set a standard. So if you give away some of your code and that helps create a standard, did you make money? Yeah. So it's a good question. I think you can, and I think they do.
Thank you. Can we pull the mic down here?
There's also one other option to that, and that is, just because you're making a business doesn't mean it has to be your only business. You could still have your day job and use it as a secondary income source. The folks at LimeWire do that, for instance. They distribute this Napster-ish kind of software, you know, you can get it for free, or you can pay the commercial license, and it takes out some of the adware and gives you some other nifty little enhancements. But you know, they sell it for $10, I think, is the add-on, and they're just doing it because they like open source, but they want to make a little extra side money, so it's a secondary income source for them.
My name is Mike Blonder, and the name of my company is IMB Enterprises, and I think you've done a great job trying to reinforce your question over and over again, and I think many people haven't really directly spoken to the question, so I want to try to give my view on it. I think, as JT said, definitely if you're trying to market open source, whether it's your code or you're trying to give services, and you're trying to market it, it's a business. And if you don't approach it as a business, you're dead meat. Okay? And so, to your point, I forget the gentleman's name from Red Hat, that open source is about to...
Ed, if you're in doubt here, just call him Ed. We've got a couple of Eds.
Yeah, Ed. I disagree with you 110,000% because it's a business. If you're in business, you're in business, and you got to make it work. So what does Dudley Do Right do? He's got 650,000 people that know his code because it's on SourceForge or it's somewhere like that. He has to leverage that contact list. He has a huge contact list of 650,000 people that have downloaded the code. Now, if you know what happened with Microsoft and Netscape, the scariest thing for Microsoft was the fact that Netscape gave it away, and Netscape had this huge contact list of millions and millions and millions and millions of people who had that code. The problem that we're seeing here in this meeting today is very few people resonate with the marketing to that 650,000 member list. Everybody wants to do something proprietary that makes it easy for you, because you're a developer and you know how to write code and you want to run that route to make a business. But you know what? Dudley Do Right can make a business around the 650,000 people that are on that list, because he knows that code better than anybody does. And you've got to bet dollars to donuts that there's at least 1% to 3% of those 650,000 people that need some services and support. So that's it.
Thanks. Very good.
And I'm in marketing.
My name is Derek Sr. I have a company called DWS. And
say it louder. I didn't hear.
My name is Derek Sr. and I have a company called DWS. We're a distribution company. We distribute cappuccino beverages, our own beverage products, and we distribute video distribution systems. I'm a business person. I'm not a coder. My confidence has gone up just sitting here over the last hour and a half, because I'm going to make money with open source. It's wonderful. I agree. It's where are you? Are you either are you a coder or are you a business person? Because I agree with what this gentleman said. There's money to be made out of that contact list. And I don't think it's about the code so much as it is about offering some basic business practices, which is excellent customer service, developing relationships, looking at models of good business. I could take any CMS, and if it's got good basic code, if it handles solutions, it's about how do you handle and solve people's problems. That's what we're really about if you're a business. Because if you're a business, you're not about the code. You're about listening to what your customer wants and solving those problems. I'm almost amazed. And it's not a negative against coding. It's just I'm surprised at how I've heard from, you know, from a coding standpoint, because I'm involved with a lot of them recently because we're looking to put CMS out there. I see an enormous need for especially small businesses to have a good CMS. But I'm not hearing people listen to customers. They're talking about the code. Want to make money? Listen to the customer and then offer exceptionally good service and give them solutions. These guys are busy running their business. They don't want to talk code. They don't even want to talk about it. They just want to know that their business is being taken care of. And who's going to do that? You.
And okay, pass it down to Andy down here. Right there.
Hello, I'm Andy Singleton from Assembla. I would like to ask a question of Gregor and of JT about what they said about customers putting code back so that they can stay on the maintenance stream. And specifically, the question is whether you guys think that some of the huge reservoir of code that is proprietary code written by user companies for their own use will be put into open source and into industry consortiums in order to ease its enhancement and maintenance.
Yeah, that's definitely what we are seeing. A lot of companies are reassessing their IT and trying to shed as much as they can. And one example, we are very much in the newspaper industry. And the three biggest newspapers in Switzerland, which really compete against each other, recently decided that they should share their IT infrastructure. So that they compete on content, not on the infrastructure. So what they're going to do is put all their code together, and they will run on an open source platform, and all major players will contribute with their expertise. And since they have about 60% of the Swiss market, other newspapers are expected to follow. So what they're doing is what I mentioned earlier, that they're trying to set their own industry standards to make it easier to shop around for solutions and to share development costs. So yes, we are seeing it.
In my experience, it depends on what the code is doing. Everybody, we have clients that have one person at the whole company, all the way up to, you know, Fortune 500 clients and federal government clients and things like that. And it really depends on what the application, what the code thing is that they're putting into there. Some of the federal government agencies, for instance, have written different authentication mechanisms for one of our products, and they don't want that public because of security reasons is what they cite. Or some of the Fortune 500 companies are doing things with things like Sarbanes-Oxley and applications like that, and they don't want to release those either just because they're afraid, you know, some shareholder will get a hold of something that they shouldn't or whatever. But in our experience, almost everything, if there's no security implication, everybody releases it back into the code base because they want to keep their upgrade path as simple as possible. And in fact, to prove that, WebGUI 5.3 was just released last week, and something like 60% of the code in it was contributed. It wasn't written by our staff. So
let me tell you what Dudley did. Dudley pulled back some of his code best he could, packaged it up in a way, and put it out under a proprietary license, and suddenly his email box was flooded with flames from all the guys and women he used to hang out with at open source conferences, calling him some kind of just, I mean, I can't even tell you the names. I mean, it was just awful.
Our fond of talking about is that there's a commons there, and there's a mutual commitment to participate in the commons. So when someone kind of pulls out, people see a lessening of that commitment. And it has social and market import.
So is the lesson
I'm not excusing it, but That's what's happening.
So is the lesson of this session this morning that if you're going to make money, you're not going to be a commons contributor?
I think you can do both, but if you swing to one side or the other, it's going to be perceived differently. Like if you go open source, if you swing to the open source side, clearly the community is going to be happy and, you know, sprinkle rose petals on you. If you go the other way, you're going to get some flameage, and that's just because of the culture.
Huh. Fritz?
I think there is a...
Tell us who you are.
Dmitry Borodenko, SAM Solutions, Minsk, Belarus.
Say it again louder and slower.
Okay.
I want them all to
Dmitry
know how far
Borodenko, Minsk, Belarus. I think the reason why we have a long discussion of this issue is that because we're discussing the wrong question. I think this panel should be renamed to "You Can't Make Money with Software." Because what some panelists said, like JT, he was saying this all the time, that he doesn't make money with software, he does it with services, with support, and so on. So does Red Hat. They don't do money with Red Hat Linux, they do with software and everything else around it.
Excellent.
Well, my question is kind of a follow-up.
Tell us who you are.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Rick Anderson from Rutgers University. And my question is more along the lines of that, you know, open source has really got all these unique benefits. It's got that business model aspect, all of that. But how is it actually revolutionizing content management? You know, like where is it? Are people considering open source content management programs over the closed source? You know, what is that direction? How does this relate to, you know, me, a client, saying, all right, I want to pick this piece of software over that piece of software in the content management space?
Well, that really is the question of the afternoon panel. That is, that's it. You're right on it. What's been set up for the afternoon is a discussion that is intended to take the user's point of view, asking the question of the open source content management community, have you really got something for us? What is it? Are you listening to us?
What I'm hearing is that the open source community is more likely to respond to the need that the individual customer is going to bring in. So, for instance, in terms of my content management, if I'm trying to manage, say, a university secretary's office, and they all have Word documents that need to be managed, then if I'm going out that route, there may be a person in that open source area or a company that would, you know, target that type of activity or add it back into their overall product. So now that maybe they have a web portal management tool that does that content management, now you can integrate, say, the office documents from one person into that general panel. So the idea is that, hey, now I can use the tool for the webmaster as well as the university secretary.
Okay,
that's the direction.
Pass back to Larry.
I want to follow up a little bit on a point I was making earlier. I'm struck by the similarity that might occur if this were a meeting of prospective restaurateurs or people opening restaurants and saying, is there any money to be made off of selling hamburgers? And the fact is that, sure, there is, but it's going to take an awful lot to compete head-on with, say, McDonald's or Wendy's or Burger King. Those are big companies. And so in order to compete, you either make a better hamburger, but you're probably not going to make a lot of money. What you are going to be able to do is support attendance at conferences like these and be able to, you know, put your kids in school and things of that sort. But in order to make a lot of money, or in order to really make a big success, I think what you really need is what Red Hat is now getting, which is strong, skilled business people who know how to run a business. Anyone can run a restaurant, and quite frankly, I think nowadays almost anyone can write software and sell it and distribute it on SourceForge. But in order to make a real business, you're going to have to be a business person. So this conference ought to focus not just on how to make money, but how to be business people.
Pass it over to here.
Carl Hacken, I'm a sociologist, actually, and I...
Say it again?
Carl Hacken, I'm a sociologist. I study open source developers. I want to...
Don't be uncomfortable.
Is this a whole new field? Is this...
there have been a few of us working on studying computer science for maybe 25 years now, but it's a field that's starting to grow really quickly, especially because now that academic jobs are getting more and more scarce, we can support ourselves as developers occasionally. But I want to do what academics do best, which is ask a couple of the emperor has no clothes questions. The first thing is I keep hearing people say, make money, and I keep hearing Gary Becker, who I've spent some time working with, saying, the only person who can make money is the federal government, right? What we're really talking...
Put the microphone up a little closer to your mouth.
I'm sorry. What we're really talking about here is either generating wealth or generating revenue, right? And these two different things are really important for open source developers to keep in mind as they're thinking about how do we make business out of open source, because it's pretty easy to generate revenue off of open source, and getting the idea of how you generate wealth out of generating revenue is the really tough thing, right? So I'd like the...
I have to say, I'm a lawyer. I'm not an economist here. And I'm missing it. If I'm generating revenue, don't I generate wealth if I just hang on to it?
I see you shaking your head, so...
Well. Generating revenue is one thing, but your revenue has to exceed your expenses by certain percentages, otherwise you're obviously not generating wealth.
Oh, yes, forgive me.
So, and this is really relevant to content management, because there have been innumerable studies, and in fact, it's probably the single example of things social scientists have looked at the most in terms of software development are content management systems. And we've never seen one work in the way that we would think of something working. So it may be the case that there are successful implementations out there that, you know, the software continues to run. But do they ever solve the social need or meet the social purpose for which an organization actually spends the time and energy to build the software? We've never seen an example, right? Now, I could take that a half step further and say, until a couple of years ago, we never knew what we were looking at was content management, right? So maybe the change is happening now. Maybe this is because it's becoming content management, it's starting to actually work. But the solution we've
always... Can I just slow you up again?
Sure.
You say you've never seen one work from a sociologist's point of view.
Right.
What does that mean?
We've never seen a case where a piece of software that performs the kind of activity content management claims to perform actually creates the social change that's used as the original justification for spending money on the system. Well, maybe that's my answer. What Dave said, that weblogs are an example of content management systems, and they're ones that work. And I don't think I could really argue with that. But there's still this other category. I mean, you don't need a content management system software thing to run a weblog, right?
Hey, Dave, we haven't got two microphones, so stand up and come on down here to this one. Okay. So go ahead. We've been heading you off here. You haven't quite gotten to your point yet, right?
Well, so the point that I'm trying to get to is, does the emperor have no clothes? Right? Is there actually such a thing as making money or generating wealth, generating revenue even off... What I was trying to get at is there such a thing as generating wealth off of content management? That was the real question I was trying to get at, right? And how does that happen?
Now, there must be someone here who can answer this question. I don't frankly understand it, but somebody here must have gotten this one. Here, there's a right back there.
Hi, thanks. Bob Boyko from the University of Washington.
Ah, there we go.
I would agree with your first point about most software solutions not actually addressing the sociological problem that's in organizations. But I think that's completely different than generating wealth from a content management system. In the first case, I think it's been stated by some other people here as well, that the primary problem of a content management system is to link people who have intellectual value with people who need intellectual value in the most abstract sense. Most software developers are interested in having the most parsimonious solution to a technical problem. Those two sometimes coincide, those two sometimes don't coincide. So I think that the times that I've seen a content management solution succeed is when people weren't really talking about a solution as much as they were talking about, we need to link the people who have information with the people who need information, and we're going to come up with some infrastructure for doing that, and we'll grab pieces from wherever we need to grab them in order to make that happen. And I think where I've seen it miss the mark most is where people start with, we need an elegant solution to distributing content among these 15,000 servers. We need to fill a browser very quickly. We need to minimize download time. We need to maximize the efficiency of our servers, et cetera. That's really not the problem that content management purports to solve. The problem that it purports to solve is matching people with information. As far as generating wealth from content management systems, I've seen that many times. I've seen many examples of people who have either cut expenses or increased revenue by implementing an automated content solution. One thing that it certainly does is it increases the efficiency of the whole process, so that you don't have redundancy, so you don't have you maximize basically the efficiency of the process. But the other thing it does is it increases the revenue opportunities if your organization knows how to make money from information. And if it doesn't know how to make money from information, then no content management system in the world is going to help. But if it does, it certainly facilitates maximizing the availability of that information and spreading it around the most.
Hello, my name is Vanessa Lane. I'm from Turk, and there's a miscommunication between you two. You are talking about a company creating wealth through an instance of a content management system, and you were talking about the development of content management systems on the abstract as a product to be commodified. Yes? No? Maybe? You were... Okay. Oh, very good. I wanted to add the comment that I think that there is much to be said for your observation that content management systems generally don't succeed in their justification that is initially brought forth. That is, in fact, El Dorado. If anyone succeeds in doing that, those templates are paved with gold.
All right.
Hi, and I'd like to say that there are a lot of companies now that are hiring sociologists to design around this problem, exactly this problem. And they think of themselves as CMS companies, and many of them are looking to do part of it in open source and shelter part of it because that's how you get venture capital now. So that hybrid model isn't going to go away, I don't think. But the other problem, the content management problem, I think is going to solve itself over time.
Well, I love the idea of sociologists studying open source. I think that's just got an excellent feel to it.
Kind of fun.
Here, we've come to the end of our panel discussion here, and I want to just give the opportunity to our panelists to each say one word in conclusion. JT, you got anything, you know, a benediction for the crowd?
Wow, put me on the spot. No, if you're trying to make money at open source, you can. It's as simple as that. You just have to think like a business, like I said at the beginning. Don't think like a developer. Think like a business. Go to your audience. Get your list of users off of SourceForge. Build a community around your product. And the support revenues, the whatever revenues you're trying to generate, wherever your revenue stream is, it will come. But think like a business. Don't think like a developer.
Thanks. Ed?
I would say, you know, traditionally the way you make money, regardless of what business you're in, but certainly open source, is either you sell a product or you provide a service. And the margins on products are good, but the reality is most of us make our money, most of the U.S. economy makes its money on services. That's probably where you're going to make your money too. Products, as the opportunities as they come along, you know, it's the dream of every service provider to find a product they can sell, make money in your sleep. But they're tough to come by, and, you know, It's a big investment. So for a lot of us, it's just going to be making money through services for a good long time. And when the product opportunity comes, you seize it as best you can, and you run with it as far as you can.
Spoken like a lawyer.
There you go.
Ed.
I'll come back to the thing I started with. If you all of these initiatives as developers start with some source of pain. And the closer you stay to the pain, the closer you'll stay to finding where there's a way to monetize it, and too easily as developers we get away and get wrapped up in technology and sometimes functionality that just doesn't matter. But remember what the pain was that created the problem, and then seek ways to present an opportunity to minimize risk to your customers at a low cost or at a better value.
Thanks, Gregor.
You got to leverage your community, so maybe think about shifting a bit from software to social engineering and really making the best out of your community, both for your own status and all the benefits that accrue from it.
All right. I want to thank you all very much. Thank you very much to the panelists. I thank you. Dudley Do-Right, thank you. Thank you all. We've got a panel coming up at 1:30 on licensing, which, in a sense, takes this subject into a deep, dark hole. And we invite you all to come.